We hope for the best and we prepare for the worst. And it's important. What's important there is the and,
yeah.
Right? We're doing both, preparing for the so-called worst or the inevitable is not a hope killer. There comes a point in grief, typically, where you start to try to find meaning, purpose, and that often launches into how can I help others? The precious time is when you say your I love yous and your I'm sorrys, and you worry less about how much they ate and, you know, how much they're sleeping and what their pulse ox is, and you worry more, or you lean in more to the love and the intimacy.
Jennifer O'Brien, author of The Hospice Doctor's Widow, reminds us that even in life's most painful chapters, there's still beauty to be found.
Welcome to the Carti Hopecast, where we explore stories that shape us, journeys of resilience, hope, and perseverance. We seek the lessons that emerge when we face the unexpected and find strength in the struggle.
I'm Adam Head, your host, and today I'm joined by Jennifer O'Brien, an author, speaker, and longtime healthcare executive. When her husband, Dr. Bob Lindberg, was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, Jennifer became his caregiver. What began as a personal journey through grief became a published book now used to support caregivers across the country. Her story is one of enduring love, creative expression, and what she and her husband called precious time. Jennifer, thank you so much for being here. Welcome to the Hopecast.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Yeah.
You've had a long career, we were talking about earlier, in healthcare leadership, but this chapter began with what you thought at the time was a temporary move to Arkansas. Would you take us back to the beginning, what brought you here, and ultimately how you met Bob?
Sure. As you mentioned, I've been in healthcare my entire career. I like to say I started when I was 12, but that's a lie. And I came down to do an interim CEO position. I do interim leadership. I'm not a lifer. And so these jobs usually last 2 to 4 years. And I had every intention of going back to Chicago when I was finished. But I met Bob Lindberg and I fell in love with him and we got married. And I finished up the orthopedic job. We kind of lived the dream. Mm. Yeah.
And you bet Bob, as you mentioned, I mean, you thought this was going to be a short stop, but what was it about his journey from plastic surgeon to hospice physician that resonated so deeply with you?
Right. So, you know, having been in healthcare and worked predominantly at the time with surgical specialties, right? I had met plenty of surgeons.
Yeah.
The night I met him and he told me his story that he had been a very successful plastic and reconstructive surgeon for 33 years. And then because of a neck injury with some residual pain, you know, the microsurgery position was impossible for him to hold without a lot of pain.
Sure.
And so he had to stop operating and had chosen to retrain in hospice and palliative medicine. And to me, that was just one of the biggest head turners I've ever experienced. Like he could have retired easily. But he didn't want to. And he looked at the different specialties and really was drawn to hospice and palliative medicine. Like I say, that was the head turner. I mean, I had lost my mother and my brother. So I knew how important palliative care and hospice was to patients and families. Mm-hmm. And so that it was just really impressive to meet someone who, you know, who could have gone on and just retired and instead retrained into the specialty that he chose. Besides, he was, you know, cute and funny and smart and all that stuff that, you know, makes a girl happy.
Yeah, well, a true commitment to his craft. I mean, making that hard pivot and learning a different specialty is no small feat.
No, indeed. And, you know, he was a very good plastic surgeon and he was did a lot of trauma. It wasn't just cosmetics. A lot of people use cosmetic surgery and plastic surgery interchangeably. And of course they're not. So he provided lots of good care when he was a plastic surgeon. But in the years after he became a palliative medicine and hospice physician, he expressed that this was really he felt like he had become the doctor he was always meant to be.
Wow.
And he really loved the specialty. Yeah.
Kind of a calling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very authentic world, right? You don't get into that area of medicine and fake it. Mm-hmm. Right. There's no way to do that.
In what was obviously a very dramatic turn for him and what would be for you, Bob was diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic renal cell carcinoma. And this obviously marked a turning point in both of your lives. Can you take us into those early days of becoming his caregiver?
Yeah, it's devastating to get that kind of news. Mm-hmm. I'm sure for yourself and certainly for loved ones. It's just absolutely devastating. And of course, Bob had been a physician in a small community, and so medicine was there for him. There were a number of doctors that were right there for him the minute the diagnosis came across. And that was wonderful, you know, but on some level, it still leaves us where we are, which is with this terminal diagnosis. I had learned along the way that through my career, actually working many, many years prior in a hem-onc, about the notion of balancing hope and preparation. Hope for the best, prepare for the worst. I worked with an oncologist who used to say that to patients at every visit. We hope for the best and we prepare for the worst. And it's important. What's important there is the and, right? We're doing both. Preparing for the so-called worst or the inevitable is not a hope killer. We can do both.
Yeah.
And we did. We started on that almost immediately. The best and the worst changes over time, right? At first, when we first got the results back that it was a cancer and that it was a stage 4, they sent the specimen to a special lab to determine whether there was a targeted therapy. So in those couple of weeks, right, the best was, that we'll have a targeted therapy and this thing will be cured. And when that came back not the case, then the best becomes really good time together and time to share our lives, to prepare and be close. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, you know, not the worst becomes not suffering.
Yeah.
Right. That sort of thing. So, yeah.
Well, as you were navigating this new reality, you turned to art journaling.
I did.
How did that practice begin? And what did it offer you in the middle of this new grief, exhaustion, and uncertainty you were facing?
Yeah. So interestingly, I had started the art journaling of a sort when my mother died, which was 21 years ago. And back then it would have been about 12 years prior. When Bob got sick, so I'm a collage artist, because I can't draw very well and, putting things together and layering things, I think is just such an important part of the artistic expression. When Bob got sick, I decided to teach myself digital collage. And that was sort of this perfect balance of head and heart, right? Like I knew how I wanted to make it look, but it couldn't quite, I didn't know the program well enough to, right? So that I had to use my head to figure some stuff out, which really helped with the heart, you know, balance out the heart stuff, because the heart stuff was pretty deep and at times, you know, very painful. And I knew that we had, you know, I wanted to document my feelings, my thoughts. It was really a form of self-care. And so, yeah, I just started putting together these collages and then you write the journal notes kind of on top of the collage. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm going to say a phrase that became pretty powerful for you. this was said to you, you need to give this to my wife. You said this moment, sharing your journal with a friend's spouse, changed everything. What did it reveal to you about the power of your story?
That was a good friend of mine who was diagnosed with a very aggressive and rare cancer, and he had lost both of his parents to cancer. I went down immediately upon hearing about his diagnosis. He lived in New Orleans. I packed a suitcase and went down to be with him and his wife and some friends of ours. And at the last minute, I threw this stack of pages. I had put my poor printer through almost a hospice situation itself to print out this document, and I threw it in the suitcase. And he knew what I had just been through with Bob, and I said, "Here's this," you know. And he took it into the bedroom and came out the next morning and said, "That's really helpful, and you need to show this to my wife," because she had not been through a cancer diagnosis and death. And he said, "You need to show it to her because she doesn't know what she's in for." And I did, and she was very appreciative. And that made me realize that there was something there, that, you know, that sharing my story actually could help people that were going through something similar. So I went home and I used the kind of software that you put your vacation photos in and then they send you a book. You know this, right?
So, yes, we have done that at my house multiple times.
Yeah. Exactly. So I used one of those. And I dropped these JPEGs so that I had a physical book. Uh-huh. And then by that time, I was doing another one of these interim CEO positions. And a physician I was working with, who was a neurologist, told me he was diagnosing three different patients with ALS. And so I brought the book in to him to show him. And he took it home and he came back the next morning and said, "Yeah, you're not getting your journal back. I will be loaning it to these three patients, moreover to their spouses, and you need to figure out how to get that thing published, because it will really help a lot of people." And so I did. It was also at the time in my grief process, there comes a point in grief typically where you start to try to find meaning, purpose, and that often launches into how can I help others? And this was very much at that point in my grief. So when he said this, I was just compelled to find a publisher and get this journal, this art journal, published as a book.
Well, having read The Hospice Doctor's Widow this week myself, I felt like you seemed to capture a wonderful balance of the vulnerable, intimate moments of yours and Bob's story while also leaving a practical trail for others to follow. Did you intend to craft it this way initially as you were putting all this together, or did that kind of just come to you over time?
So the journal was created as a journal. It was just, I didn't intend when I created it for it to become a book.
Yeah.
I am just an incredibly practical person. So that's, I can't not be practical. Mm-hmm. So that part is kind of a given for me.
Yeah.
You know, the vulnerable stuff, the really emotional stuff is, again, that was for self-care, but it turns out that, you know, it really helps people to know that the feelings that they have, it's not all a Florence Nightingale situation. You know, there's a page in the journal that says, "If I don't get out of this house soon, he's not going to live to die of cancer, and I'm going to do life without parole." Because there were days when I thought I might murder him. so it's it really helps, apparently, when you're going through something like that, to know that other people have those thoughts and feelings, and that there's nothing wrong with them. It's, we're human, and it's perfectly natural. It's not all, you know, it's not like it is in the movies.
Yeah. No, it was, I imagine it could be very relatable for people who are feeling all of those feelings that they're wondering if that's normal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or feeling bad about themselves because they are having those thoughts and feelings. And there's nothing bad about those thoughts and feelings. Mm. They're perfectly natural.
Well, Jennifer, there's a part of your journey that notes some of the fight or battle language that can often be associated with someone's cancer journey. Certainly some people commonly use this type of warrior wording, this metaphor, if they find it to be helpful for them. But for others, and specifically in your husband's case, it really wasn't all that helpful. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I would love to talk about that. I find the war language and the sports language both insufficient, inaccurate, and just downright annoying when it comes to trying to live a life fully with a disease or condition, whether it's terminal or not. It's just not that binary, right? It's not a win-lose.
Yeah.
It's not a black-white. It's just not that binary. And I feel like that language, perpetuates that. And perhaps above all, people, when they say in an obituary, so-and-so lost their battle with, this is very upsetting to me. My husband was not a loser because he died at the end of his life. We will all die at the end of our lives, and we're not losers. And that's just really frustrates me. I like to focus on, like I said, the living fully, rather than some idea that I wasn't good enough or I didn't do something hard enough. And it's so much more than a fight. There's a lot of love, and sometimes there's some really great laughter, and there's great memories being made. This is so much richer than just win-lose.
Yeah, totally. Well, there's a surrender to control a bit there, too, in some of those cases. And certainly you can do all that you can through treatment, but there are those circumstances where you're just navigating this new reality. That certainly came through in the book. Bob used the phrase precious time.
He did.
In his work with patients. How has that idea stayed with you? And what does it mean to truly embrace that window that you speak of when the fight may be over, using that kind of language, but you're still in the middle of a connection? That connection is still possible.
Yeah. So Bob would tell patients and families, you're into precious time. And he always put the emphasis on the word precious. And I, being from the North and Bob being from Texas, I kind of thought this was a Southern thing that he, like Southerners say umbrella insurance, right? But it wasn't that. The emphasis was on the word precious because this is the type of time. This is a distinct period of time, the end of life. And it was the way that he was able to communicate to families, this ends soon. This doesn't go on forever. And that's particularly important for the family caregiver, I think. The average duration of family caregiving is 4.5 years. That's the average. So you could spend a decade, right, making sure that the person you're caring for gets a good meal every day, or, got a good night's sleep, or was able to live as fully as they possibly could that particular day. And then there comes a time when the end is in sight, and we don't always see it, right? Because we've been working so hard at being a life-sustaining family caregiver that shifting to end-of-life family caregiver is tough. And certainly in our culture and in medicine, we don't hear that a lot. It's coming to an end. But Bob had this way of saying that was kind and gentle. And he got thank you notes from families. Thank you for telling us that it was coming to an end. Because the worst thing, I think he thought, was for a family to live with a loved one who has an illness for sometimes months or years, and then that person dies, and they said, and they would say, and this happens all the time, but I thought we had more time. And all the signs were there, but nobody told them. Nobody said, you're into precious time. And precious time is when you say your I love yous and your I'm sorry's, and you worry less about how much they ate and, you know, how much they're sleeping and what their pulse ox is. And you worry more, or you lean in more to the love and the intimacy. And, you know, I think it's a way of really addressing it. I think it eases grief, right? The grief that's ahead, because you did lean in and say all that you had to say, and you didn't say things that were just quite frankly a waste of breath at that stage in someone's life. So yeah, I love the term precious time. And of course, because Bob coined that term, I felt like we were in precious time from the point of diagnosis. He lived for 22 months.
Yeah.
I just, you know, felt knowing he was going to die, felt that this is important that I go on after his death and not have regrets about silly little arguments or not treating this time as the precious time that it is. So that's why it was one of the first pages of the journal that I did about precious time. And I really loved how the world has received this term. I got a wonderful note from a nurse in an ICU nurse up in Canada who had read the book and said that they had had a patient who was very clearly nearing death. And the young doctor that was caring for her didn't want to tell her family. He didn't want to say it. It's too hard to say your loved one is dying. And he was hesitant and he wouldn't call them. And she told him about precious time, the term and the language and Bob's story. And he called and told them, you're into precious time with your mom. And so, and they were able to all come in and see her before she died. So that's happening, which is wonderful.
Well, it certainly does. Again, using that, the battle or war language. It makes it where it's not binary, but it's a refocus of what you have.
Right. Right. There. Right. Yeah. You have this left, you have this precious time left. It is worth everything,
yeah.
You know, to be able to make sure that you said, I love you, your I love yous or your I'm sorry's or whatever it is, or it's okay to go, your goodbyes, those sorts of things. It's just worth everything.
You've spoken openly about the disorientation that can come after caregiving ends. What did your transition into now widowhood look like, and what helped you navigate it?
Well, I would say there were two things that helped tremendously. The first thing that helped was the fact that Bob and I very thoroughly prepared for his death and my survivorship. And I cannot stress that enough.
Okay.
I strongly recommend you start that preparation before anybody gets sick, which we did. We had, you know, our trusts and we had all of our advance directives. And of course, we had had numerous conversations long before anybody got a diagnosis. That's important to do that work in the abstract because things do change once somebody gets sick. You know, it can affect, you might want to try a clinical trial or something that in the abstract you didn't think much of. And then when he did get sick, I mean, when I say we thoroughly prepared, I am not exaggerating with the use of that word. We sold our house because he knew I was not going to do well in that big and old house by myself. We bought a condo and moved into it and were able to be there together for 10 months before he died. I mean, every last bit of paperwork, there were a couple things that I forgot to do that, you know, I kind of regretted, but pretty much everything was done before he died, such that when he did die, everything was in place for me. You know, I didn't have to deal with probate. I didn't have to wonder, you know, find hidden bank accounts or insurance policies or things like that. I didn't have to do any of that. I just needed to love and miss him and grieve him. And that's a beautiful thing, is to be able to just purely grieve someone instead of the mess that that most people deal with because they didn't do the preparation. And then the other thing that really helped me a lot, of course, friends and folks that stuck with me, and art, you know, making is an important, I think is just incredibly comforting and therapeutic, is just to be a maker and make stuff, whatever your medium is.
Yeah. Well, today you speak to medical professionals, caregivers, and families. What are you finding people are most hungry to hear, and what messages do you find yourself repeating?
Yeah, I find myself repeating the preparation message quite a bit. I find myself just being an advocate and validating the trials of family caregivers. I have done very hard jobs in my career. Mm-hmm. I have never done anything as hard as family caregiving. I mean, it is a bigger job than anything else I've done. And I've done it repeatedly now, not just with Bob, but my mom and dad. And the other thing that I stress is, you know, so death happens to everyone. Death is greater than the best medical center. Death is greater than a healthy lifestyle. Death is greater than remission. Death is greater than a cure. You will still die at the end of your life. Love is the only thing that's greater than death. And approaching it both practically and viscerally is incredibly important for both your life with the people you love, your life after the people you love die, and the end of your own life.
Well, you've said that this work is a continuation of Bob's legacy. What does your life look like today, and how do you continue to honor his memory?
So I've written a second book that is very different than the art journal. It's very practical.
Yeah.
And I'm working on another project that I'm not going to go into any detail about, but I'm absolutely loving it. I love working in the end of life space. It's a beautiful part of the world. I've worked in healthcare a long time, and there can be some jerks in healthcare. There are no jerks in end of life. They self-select out of the specialty. Mm. It's just, there's no room for that in end of life. I feel very fulfilled, and I think Bob would be proud of me, I think.
Well, Jennifer, we really appreciate you sharing this incredibly personal story. I think that your book has already helped a lot of people, and I know it's continuing to help people. What message would you offer to someone who is caring for a loved one in a season that feels impossible?
The message, just the basic message I would give is just keep going. It is indeed the hardest job, but it's also the most fulfilling. Mm. And you will come to a point where, you know, as hard as it was, you wouldn't trade it for anything. Mm. I can also
I would love for you to.
I will not miss the sleepless nights filled with his relentless moaning, wheezing, and suffering. I will not miss trying yet failing to comfort him. I will not miss wrapping his swollen legs. I will not miss giving him injections. I will not miss changing the sheets in the middle of the night because of his night sweats. I will miss loving someone so much that I do all of those things. That's what it is for a caregiver. There's a lot of stuff you don't miss. But loving someone, yeah, you're going to miss that.
Jennifer O'Brien, we appreciate you being on the Hopecast today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.